This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
On today's program, Immigration and Politics, with Oscar Chacon, Executive Director of the National Alliance of Latin American and Caribbean Communities, and Angelo Falcon, President and Founder of the National Institute for Latino Policy. But first...
This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Trump and the politics of resentment. When New York billionaire and GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump launched into his anti-immigrant tirade against Mexicans crossing the border, he was using a long-term political technique of plugging into the live wire of American resentment of the other. Today, it's Latinos, of course, more precisely, those from the southern borders, Mexicans, Salvadorans, Guatemalans, Hondurans, and the like. But since the 19th century, politicians have used these currents of fear to fuel movements against those who came from abroad. In those days, though, the targets of nativist ire were those from Ireland, Jews from Russia, people from Italy, and other European sites. These forces gave birth to the American Party, a fierce anti-immigrant group that became known popularly as the Know-Nothings. They formed a third party during the 1850s and ran former U.S. President Millard Fillmore as their unsuccessful candidate. U.S. historian Richard Hofstadter, in his classic work, The Paranoid Style in American Politics, argued that much of the energy of the anti-immigrant forces stemmed from what might be called status anxiety, or the intense insecurities of people unsure of their place in U.S. society, but who could point to others, immigrants, who held weaker positions in society. Furthermore, these same anxiety-ridden groups often have mixed feelings of fear and admiration of social elites. And who is more elite in America than the super rich? Witness the spectacle of Donald Trump, who, without question, is perhaps the richest man ever to run for president, and has a billionaire populace, no less. I wouldn't get too excited about his place in the polls right now. In 2012, the toast of both press and polls was a pizza exec named Herman Cain. We know how that worked out. But most candidates, especially of the GOP, worship at the throne of the wealthy, for they are the ones they serve. The thousands and perhaps millions who rage at Latino immigrants also worship the rich. In Donald Trump, they have found their voice, and he has found the energies of resentment, undeniable fuel for failure. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And now, from Trump and Politics of Resentment, political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal ushers us into our next discussion. Joining us from Mexico City, the Executive Director of the National Alliance of Latin American and Caribbean Communities, Oscar Chacon.
I'm very happy to be with you.
And Angelo Falcon, President and Founder of the National Institute for Latino Policy.
Also calling a faraway place, Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
From Trump and Politics of Resentment. But, Oscar, the vicious tirade that last election was kind of reserved for Tom Tancredo has now been picked up by Trump. It's been picked up by Christie as well, who is referring to immigrants as though they were chattel to be tracked as FedEx packages. What does need to be the debate around the immigrants that are here that have helped build this country and those who should be allowed in?
First of all, let me just say that I really believe that Donald Trump is indeed a very dangerous politician for the United States of America, not only for immigrants. I believe that what he is doing is very masterfully taking advantage not just of the racism and xenophobia that still exists in America, but I believe he's also being very clever in the way he's manipulating a wide range of economic fears that have accumulated over the last three or so decades and that are largely, you know, the result of the very global economic system that the United States of America has championed around the world, and that creates, as I said, I mean, broad resentment, insecurity, anxiety across, you know, a broader spectrum of populations in the U.S., not the least of them, white population in the U.S. He is, of course, I mean, manipulating also the demographic changes that have occurred also in the same period of time, the last 30, 35 years. And the most important aspect of this demographic shift, on one hand, is the fact that Latinos, mainly those from Mexico and other Latin American countries, have become a very important engine in what everybody now knows, namely that Latinos have already become the second largest ethnic cultural group in the U.S. and bound to grow even more in the years to come. And this brings, obviously, lots of cultural shifts in the U.S. as well, which if you combine with the geographic proximity, in this case of Mexico most of all, it only creates even more fear. But I also believe that there is a question of globalization and its effect. For example, not long ago, Trump delivered a speech in Detroit essentially talking against the very offshoring of jobs, you know, that has gone on for the last 3.5 decades or so, as if he were not part of the very forces that have shaped that particular shift in the labor market in the U.S. And across the world. So again, I believe that Trump is indeed much more dangerous than Tancredo ever was, because Tancredo didn't have the ability to actually combine all these realities that do create legitimate fears in many instances and manipulate them in the service of advancing essentially a racist, you know, hate-driven agenda against immigrants, but also others.
Angelo, do you agree with Oscar on this point? And especially, I haven't heard the Democrats countering Trump in any way with regard to his anti-immigrant rants. It's not just the Republicans. Are we moving to the right on these issues?
My take is I think Trump is doing us a great public service. I think he's unmasking, I think, some of the worst elements in the Republican Party and on the right. The kind of, you know, rhetoric that we hear from the establishment Republicans has been kind of like also anti-immigrant in many ways, but they try to use a different type of language. I mean, their own autopsy when they were talking about how to approach the Latino community had nothing to do with any changes in policy, but rather its style. And I think one of the things that Trump is doing is kind of basically unmasking what's behind that style, the kind of response that the other Republican candidates have to his racist comments, I think, are very revealing. On the Democratic side, I think basically the Democrats probably feel that they have very little to say, have to counter, because they figure the kind of reaction he's getting, he's mobilizing, for example, Latino voters for the Democrats at this point. So they have they don't have to really go out of their way to say very much, except to reiterate, you know, their general support for immigration reform, that kind of thing, without really bothering to take them on. So I think he creates a real interesting kind of situation. The polarization he's creating is, I think, in many ways damaging the Republican Party politically in terms of next year. And Republican candidates haven't really supposedly been affected as much. But I think in time, when it comes down to the general election, I think he would have caused, I think, a lot of damage. And to me, from the point of view of a more kind of a progressive side of politics, actually, in the end, this actually may be a good thing.
I want to just move to a little seemingly different issue, and we will get back to the policies that we really do need to advocate in terms of progressive immigration reform. Despite some steady job growth in the U.S. economy, the Latino unemployment rate remains absolutely stubbornly higher than the national unemployment rate. And I wonder if, Angelo, if we can start with you this time, and Oscar, if you can both chime in on this.
One of the problems we have in terms of the Latino community is that when we're talking about Latinos that are in the labor force and very high labor force participation rates compared to others, we're talking about low-wage workers, people whose job histories are very sporadic. We have also a large number of people in the Latino communities that live under the poverty line as well. And so what you have is a long-term problem in terms of the integration of Latinos into the workforce has been very, very troubled over time. It's a similar problems that black community faces in terms of labor. So it's not a surprise. It's I've been around long enough to see these figures being pretty persistent and kind of talking about how basically whole groups of people, communities, are taken by this economic system and are utilized in a certain way that keeps them marginalized, keeps them as a kind of a reserve, the old term, right, reserve army of labor just to basically keep the workers generally in line politically and economically. So that's kind of been the role that our community has been playing, and certainly as you get more and more recent immigrants coming, people with an even more tenuous ties to the labor market, they continue to play that kind of role. So the issue of the high unemployment rate in the Latino community is one that is very functional to the way the system works. That's kind of the role that Latinos have been playing in the American economy.
Just to add, I mean, to put it in context, it's important to remember that one of the main characteristics of job creation, not only from 2008 to the present, but throughout the last, again, three or so decades, has been that all jobs, either go abroad or disappear. New jobs that are created do not have the same capacity to provide the same type of wage that it used to provide. And so, yes, there has been, new jobs created, but the quality of these jobs from the wage point of view or from the benefits point of view that these jobs offer are simply not comparable to the jobs, that disappear. And this translates, obviously, in a worse manner when it comes to racial minorities, primarily African Americans and Latinos in the labor force, just to echo basically what Angela was saying.
So also, I think it's important to realize that, even though Latinos are like 16% of the labor force in the country, they make up only like 9% of Latino workers are, for example, unionized. And there's been a concerted effort, as you guys have reported, and we know for the longest time, to kind of attack the labor unions, the role of the labor unions. And as Latinos are, beginning to increasingly participate in unions, we find that, again, it's at a time when these unions are being attacked, their resources are being limited. And so that's another thing that kind of contributes to instability because, there was a report that was just issued by the Murphy Institute here in New York, which showed that, for example, in New York City, where the major unions are public sector unions, the union participation rate of blacks and Latinos exceeds that of whites, for example, because of the large number, relatively speaking, that are in public sector employment. Once you leave New York City, you go to other parts of the country, the union participation rates of Latinos goes to like almost nothing, 2%, 3%, 4%. That has a tremendous impact in terms of the ability of Latinos to become stable parts of the labor market. And that's certainly that attack on the unions is something that also has a tremendous impact on our community.
Fighting for more unions and more union participation should definitely be, and I believe it already is to a significant degree, a Latino issue that we ought to be concerned with.
And Oscar, to make the transition to immigration reform, President Obama's executive order, which was about 6 months ago, is held up in the courts. Where are we with immigration reform right now?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that, unfortunately, the strategy that has dominated essentially since 2002 until the present in terms of the immigration policy reform really has not worked the way people expect it to work. Namely, if both predictions made back in 2006, back in 2008, were to have come through, there would have been some sort of immigration reform bill. However bad it may have been in terms of reinforcing the logic of particularly tough enforcement against immigrant communities, but there would have been something, but the bottom line is there is nothing. And what this means essentially is that one of the very few resources left to the White House is indeed the use of administrative relief measures, like the one provided by the president in 2012 and like the one enacted just last November. But on this last one, it is important to understand that the enemies of these type of measures did their homework really well and managed to essentially ensure that these new measures that were announced on November 20th last year didn't actually get to see the light of day in terms of implementation. The measures are still very much entrenched in the U.S. courts. If we are lucky, we may be able to see some resolution by next summer, and that is if we are lucky. I mean, we may well face a situation where these measures will still be in court by the time President Obama is scheduled to leave the White House. Now, coming to the larger question of what are we to do about the fact that we still have an immigration policy that is deeply divorced, you know, from reality and is still in urgent need of change, I would argue that there is one thing that we have been kind of neglecting over the years and that the Trump campaign in a way reminds us about, and it is how little we have really advanced in terms of moving public opinion when it comes to the perception that most people have about today's immigrants, understanding by today's immigrants, Mexican and other Latin American immigrants, which make up, you know, the bulk of immigrants in the U.S. Today. I definitely believe that we must be far more creative in terms of how to really revamp our approach to changing public perception about immigrants. I definitely believe that we need to also be very specific in the future in targeting the 1996 immigration law in as far as reversing it, because for as long as that law remains in the books, we are not going to see any kind of meaningful reform coming into place. And I would also say just to end, I mean, that I think it's crucial to open our eyes, I mean, to the fact that immigration reform is such a complicated undertaking that we may not actually ever succeed by trying to pass a single standalone bill to change it. But rather, we may be much better luck and more effective if we were to conceive changes in immigration policy as a matter of incremental changes that need to happen over time. I would just say to end that the reality of human mobility, migration in this particular part of the world we live in, I don't believe it's anywhere near about coming to an end. And I believe that for as long as we neglect the basic question of why are people making the hard decision to leave their own country to come look for a better future in a place like the U.S., we are going to continue to meet 50% of the difficulties that represents to even attempt to change immigration policy in a meaningful way. I think that what's going on in Europe right now reminds us also of how this issue is nowhere near disappearing from the world stage, and certainly it will not disappear in our own context in the U.S.
Angel Falcone, so in relationship to what Oscar has been saying, talk from your perspective about what are some of the factors that drive people here, Latinos, immigrants, people from indeed Puerto Rico who have been forced to leave in droves the island at this time, and that whole underpinnings of this country as having a virulent anti-immigrant backward mentality when it comes to really to white nationalism, to certainly anti-immigrant racist sentiment.
Yeah. First of all, I don't know what to do with those crazy folks, you know? these extremists, I don't know what to do with these people. Within the United States, I guess they have the right to come out with all their racist stuff. The main thing is to organize around them and to make sure that the American public gets a better understanding. And I think we've seen it in polls of the role of immigration. You have these situations where, you know, you have this kind of backlash at points. But I think the point is, and we see it in the discussion beginning slowly to emerge in Europe, is the role of immigration in the economic development of any country. What we find is Western countries are aging, and you need new sources of workers. And certainly that's been the history of the United States, And right now, it's a situation where the American people and political leaders need to recognize the positive role that immigration plays, an integral part of the development of the United States. The question of how to regularize it so that people don't have to come here illegally because of their economic circumstances in their home country is something that needs to be worked out. It's very complex. We're not only talking about policies within the United States, but also policies of the U.S., how the U.S. deals with Latin America, with Mexico, with these different countries as well in terms of helping in terms of their economic development as well. But I think the issue here in the United States is one where we need to be careful how we talk about immigration reform. There's been talk about comprehensive immigration reform, and a lot of these politicians, Democrats and others, have kind of say they're for it. But, for example, one of the worst things to do is to, for example, the legislation that apparently was, that Gang of Eight in the Senate had come up with a comprehensive immigration plan that fell through in the Congress. But that plan, which was touted as a very positive development, when you looked at the details, was draconian. It was a situation where they were putting most resources on the border in terms of enforcement, which meant further militarizing American society. At the same time, they were talking about a process of people, a path to citizenship that would take 13 years and would require all sorts of ridiculous requirements from people to be able to do this thing. It's important that when we talk about things like comprehensive immigration reform or immigration reform, that our progressive folks look at the details. What is it that these people are talking about? Because sometimes the rhetoric makes these things look better than they are, but when you look at the details of the legislation, you find out that these things are really very horrible. They create tremendous roadblocks and are very punitive in terms of immigrants. But I think the issue is, as God mentioned, is how do we get the American public to understand the integral, historically integral part role that immigration plays in the development of American society. This is not some foreign plague, but it's always been part of the engine that drives the economy in this country. So that's a challenge. I don't think we know exactly how to do it, but that's really the kind of thing that we have to move towards. And as you look at 2016, it'll be interesting during the presidential election to see how that discussion develops.
Oscar, one of the spurs that spurred Obama to issue his executive order, which has now been put in abeyance by court action, was the protests around mass deportations of Latino immigrants in this country. Has that at all abated during this period of time, or is that still continuing to the extent that it had been before?
It has decreased slightly compared to the numbers as of even last year, but sadly, the reality is that a machine has been created, going back essentially to the post-1996 immigration policy that was passed that year, that essentially exists to deport and detain foreign-born population. And this machine that has been created is largely a privatized machine. Namely, it is private companies who are building and running detention centers and very often involved also in the actual deportation of foreign nationals back to their countries. And so once you create a machine like that, once you create a monster that operates on these premises, it is very difficult to actually stop this machine from one day to the other. So sadly, this is why I would insist that most people, even activists who are very passionately involved in immigration policy reform work today, they hardly know the details about what was contained in the 1996 immigration policy that was passed by both parties back in September of 1996, and that it was signed into law by a Democratic president. One of the main things that was contained in that immigration policy was precisely a much harsher version of punishment against anybody who dared to be essentially in violation of immigration policy. This is what has led to the unprecedented numbers of people who have been deported over the last 6.5 years, most of them Mexican. But again, I think that even though we have seen a somewhat of a break in the number of deportations in the course of this year, that could change tomorrow very easily because the laws, the basic premises that have allowed for this to become the case and remain solidly in place.
Oscar, I wonder if you can tell us some of what's happening in Mexico City at the conference and whether the issue, which was just announced in the paper, that the government is... Its credibility as to suggesting that the 43 students who were disappeared were killed by drug gangs and the remains burnt is definitively not what the populace and what studies have shown to be the case or what the populace believe. Oscar?
Let me just quickly say, I'm just about actually to head out to the inauguration ceremony this evening of Metropolis 2015, which is an annual conference that happens, you know, globally. And this year, the topic of the conference is across the board topic, and it happens to be actually migration and the importance of migration for these cities around the world. And ironically, this conference is taking place at the very moment that the issue of migration, refugees, is hitting a level of attention that, you know, hasn't really had in Europe any time recently. And in Mexico, this very issue happens at a time when Mexico, for all practical purposes, has become the enforcer of U.S. border policy. You know, in Europe, people have been talking for many years about the externalization of borders, which is essentially taking your own national border to a foreign land and essentially enforce your own, you know, border policies in a foreign land. That's what is happening today with Mexico. Most Americans don't even know this. But the U.S. southern border is no longer the place where people are being stopped. It is actually the Mexican southern border. And on the issue of the 43 students that were disappeared and have not yet been accounted for in Ayotzinapa, Iguala, Mexico, clearly what was announced yesterday, the decision by an international commission that looked at the facts and essentially announced that it concluded, after looking at the facts, that there is no credibility in the statement by the Mexican government that drug gangs actually burn these people to death. So most population in Mexico, I dare to say, kind of knew that this was going to be the findings of this commission, but it is also amazing to see the president of Mexico essentially saying, oh, we are very committed to finding the truth. As if all along, he hasn't been told over and over again by many civil society organizations in Mexico that the explanation they had given before was simply ridiculous. But I foresee that it will be a very interesting conference in the next 4 days in Mexico City.
And Oscar, we're going to let you move on. And thank you for...
Thank you so much.
From Mexico City, we have been speaking with Oscar Chacon, the Executive Director of the National Alliance of Latin American and Caribbean Communities, and Angelo Falcon, President and Founder of the National Institute for Latino Policy from Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Directly from Williamsburg.
Directly. I mean, this
is
not...
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
Thank you so much. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.